How many have gone before? And tell me how many more must be lost to the Indian wars?
Ward Churchill is a Keetuk Cherokee Indian and prominent American Indian activist and author. He is also a professor of American Indian Studies and chair of the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. In addition, Ward has been a member of the Leadership Council of the Colorado American Indian Movement since 1982. We spoke with Ward recently here at Free Radio Burlington.
For a warfare fought so far from home, you can preach of peace from a righteous stand, but there ain't no peace on the Indian land.
In the 1960s, there was an FBI agent who worked to entrap activists in New England and specifically here in Vermont. I believe his name was Tommy the Traveler. Could you talk a bit about him and these tactics?
Well, Tommy the Traveler was a low-grade psychopath that was retained by the Federal Bureau of Investigation in collaboration with the intelligence divisions of several state police agencies in the Northeast to travel around in a bread truck impersonating a student radical during the 1960s. And what he would do would be infiltrate campus SDS chapters and convince them that in order to be serious, they needed to bomb the local ROTC building or the administration building or draft board or something along that line. He would lay out the plan. He would provide them the material. And then when they went to implement the action, there would be police waiting. He was an agent provocateur and basically traveled from campus to campus setting people up to engage in criminal behavior that are things that were defined as criminal in any event that they would not otherwise in all probability have engaged in. It was a classic pattern. It created a basis for propagandizing the criminality of the new left. It laid the base for the formally judicial neutralization of key activists on several campuses, and it was all a government operation. And I think that has some particular relevance in the context of certain things that have gone on in the United States lately, which has to do with creating the pretext for the implementation of ever more draconian legislation with regard to the constraints and the political rights of the citizens. Okay. There are a number of operations that have been carried out that have a very strong implication of having federal participation, notably the first of the World Trade Center bombings, and secondly, the bombing of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma. In both cases, there was federal involvement in the organizations or groups, whatever you want to call them, that carried out the bombings by federal agents, infiltrators. So there's a clear appearance that there was at least foreknowledge that these events were going to appear on the part of the federal law enforcement authorities, and that therefore they had allowed them to occur for reasons of their own, and the reasons are apparent in the fact that these were used then as a justification for increasing the power of political police activity on the part of the agencies involved.
So you think that the government had knowledge of the September 11th attacks? You know.
I have no clear evidence of that being the case, but I am saying that there is a context that involves two major so-called terrorist acts within the United States in which there was at least federal foreknowledge that the acts were going to be occurring and that no action was taken to prevent them because it was in the interest of federal authorities for them to actually occur, because it then creates a rationale in public mind of the necessity of increased police prerogatives, powers with regard to political activity for purposes of political repression, not of terrorism per se, but of political dissent.
How will the recent anti-terrorist legislation affect the FBI's ability to pursue political dissidents? Are they going to have the ability to do more or just be more open about what they already do?
They'll be able to do more in a public sort of way, but it's actually that. It's more of what it is that they've already been doing. You could look at this in a certain way, not as a fundamental change, but rather as a clarification of the operational activities of agencies like the FBI. It is, in a way, simply a legitimation of the illegitimate sorts of activities that they've engaged in all along, but it takes more than a stroke of a congressional pen or a consensus of opinion to legitimate something that's fundamentally illegitimate, even if it's within the parameters of articulated law. neutralization of political targets and so forth are illegitimate activities. There's other codifications of law that render it such, international law being one. There's no way that the domestic statutory code of any given country can contravene the requirements of international law and be considered legitimate. So basically what you have is an increasing illegitimacy in the articulated law of the United States. But it's really important to understand that the activities that are being specified in the Homeland Defense Act and so forth are activities in which the FBI has engaged throughout the course of its history, and it actually has a history that predates the FBI back into the days when the free enterprisers of the U.S. government and the cost cutters and so forth retained private agencies to fulfill the functions now performed by the FBI. And we're talking here of the Pinkerton Detective Agency, for example. They basically pioneered the techniques that the FBI is still using to this day. So target for neutralization of political activists has been part of the standard operational repertoire of the FBI all along. They're simply bringing it out front now, and they're probably going to apply it to a broader swath of people in a more public way than they have in the past, but it doesn't change anything fundamental. The question is not whether we're becoming a police state in the United States. The question is how many people are going to be willing to cognate the fact that the United States has been a police state for a very long time. The issues before us are not how to prevent consummation of a police state, but what to do about it since we're living in one.
In terms of, their tactics haven't changed at all, but there's been an increase in technology that's allowed for increased surveillance with, using less people to sort of surveil a larger amount of citizenry. Do you feel like the FBI, I know the FBI isn't necessarily the most technologically apt of the bureaus, but how have they become more sophisticated in that respect?
Well, undoubtedly they become more sophisticated in the sense that there's been an evolution of the technological capacity to surveil. They can do that in ways that they couldn't do it, say, 30 years ago. But again, you're talking about perhaps more of a quantitative than a qualitative change. It's arguable that they're gathering information in a process of surveillance now that they can't even analyze and digest, but they are storing it in case there is a eventuality. Somebody ends up self-targeting at some point in the future, then they can go back and search their indices on the information that's been compiled to build a case retroactively. It's not like somebody's actually literally listening to everything you say. It's that they have capacity to gather the information. NSA, National Security Agency, has been doing that for a very long time. That is recording, by that definition, monitoring virtually all electronic transmissions. But there's no way that they could process that information. They have to go back into the files on a contingency basis when a case arises. But the very fact that they're collecting the information and in some ways compiling it is in itself a threat, because they can create context by decontextualizing information, okay, and make the appearance of an evidentiary submission in court where there's actually nothing there. Just having the raw information available gives them that possibility. They've lacked that in the past.
But it hasn't stopped them in the past either.
It hasn't stopped them in the past, but they have a very long track record also of simply fabricating information in order to connect the dots where there is no connection in dots in criminal cases and so forth. There's been a very long history of the extra-legal utilization of the judicial system by the FBI and cooperating agencies to frame and consequently neutralize by imprisonment people that they've designated as key activists. Examples of that in recent history that you could point to would be Daruba Bin-Wahad, for example, a Black Panther leader from New York who spent 19 years on falsified information provided by the FBI. Well, that was part of it, provision of false information and the withholding of exculpatory evidence that might have exonerated him at trial. That's a New York case. He was ultimately released in, I believe, 1991, or was it 1990? And then there's Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt, who did 27 years on a similarly fabricated case where the evidence that would clearly have exonerated him was withheld and denied by the FBI after it was disclosed that they all, in all probability, had it. 27 years incarceration on a frame-up for a murder. Now, that's been overturned by a California court in the late 90s, and he is now a free man, but that does not indicate that the system works. the fact that he spent the 27 years indicates the depths of the dysfunctionality of the judicial system when it comes to political activists in the United States. These are recent cases in terms of the clarity that's been obtained by their overturning, but they're older cases in terms of when the miscarriage of justice occurred. You have to understand that these things have been going on for a very long time. It's not something new.
Just getting back to the case of Tommy the Traveler, real quick, and can we expect to see similar tactics now with the anti-corporate globalization or anti-capitalist movement that we saw with sort of the emerging of the new left? Can we sort of expect to see the same sort of level of heavy-handedness?
I think you can expect to see very much the same kind of tactics employed. In fact, there's evidence that they've been employing the same tactics with regard to right-wing and racial supremacist organizations and separatist organizations straight through the 1990s. The Weaver case out in Idaho is a clear example of that. The man was flatly entrapped by a federal agent into manufacturing a weapon. I mean, he was essentially destitute. The guy came to him and solicited him to manufacture a sawed-off shotgun, for which he offered a very substantial amount of money. So Weaver went home and did that, and then was immediately arrested and charged with trafficking in illegal firearms. That kind of entrapment, soliciting the guy to engage in a criminal activity that he was not otherwise engaged in, is very much on record, and that was done obviously for political reasons. So on that basis, you can only say that you can expect a resumption of that activity, but that that activity has never ever stopped, simply selectively applied. But what they're also banking on is that people have a great deal of confusion with regard to the kinds of activities in question and their propriety, when they should be implemented, whether they should be implemented, and so forth, in the context of political opposition in the United States. And in a state of confusion, they can come in and direct things in ways that lead to very unfortunate results for activists. We really need to have a clarification in terms of the relevance and applicability of the concept of armed struggle in the United States by people who purport to be opponents of the status quo in the United States. If we understand what, when, where, and why these things would be appropriate, we're much less inclined to get sucked into some ridiculous plot by a federal provocateur.
And I think that sort of dovetails with your essay on pacifism. Is it's really a taboo to talk about, you know, anything regarding activist tactics that are considered violent, you know, and even that's it's a word that isn't very well defined in the movement. I mean, breaking windows isn't violent. It's property destruction, and to equate the destruction of a human with the destruction of a piece of glass in front of a McDonald's is a great disjustice to the world.
Well, that's correct, especially when the people who are supposedly appalled by it and then link arms and manhandle the people who are breaking the windows with physical violence of their own. There's no consistency to the practice. What they mean is they're avoiding confrontation in physical terms with the authorities they claim to oppose, and that effectively amounts at a certain point to collaboration with those authorities to preserve the status quo. What you have is a ritual performance of opposition, which creates the appearance of democracy where there is no democracy, and thus consummates the myth that supports status quo. So if you want to join the people you purport to oppose, why not just put on your suit, tie, get your briefcase, and go down and do it, rather than pretending to be the opposite of that? That's a subterfuge. It's also self-deception, because the people who are taking that position find themselves in a posture of moral purity, while essentially they assume bleacher seats watching genocide occur, bearing moral witness. It takes a little more than the bearing of witness to halt genocide, and the question is, when are we going to get serious about coming to grips with the concrete reality of how you go about stopping a process that is genocidal? How do you come to grips with the people who are in charge of that process when clearly their mentality is such as they'll perpetrate genocide? They're not likely to be swayed by moral argument and superior purity of performance and principle. There's concrete measures that have to be taken. I'm not going to specify what those are right now because we're not in a position to make a thorough analysis on here, but it takes more than a petition campaign to get the job done. You're unlikely to have taken Adolf Hitler into a German court and got a decree that prevented him from conducting the Holocaust, for example. That's clearly understood in that context, but there is a weird kind of American exceptionalism that prevails in the mentality of the opposition just as well as the status quo, that there's a set of rules out there that applies to the entire planet, everywhere except the United States. And there's a completely different set of rules that apply in the United States, which brings people into these absurd postures of purporting to be in solidarity, say, with guerrilla movements in the third world. But anybody suggests that guerrilla movement might be appropriate to the United States is dismissed as a lunatic. You're not in solidarity with guerrillas if you renounce and repudiate guerrilla activity where it might actually have some consequence and good in terms of supporting the struggle for liberation of the people who are out there engaged in guerrilla campaigns of necessity.
Considering the level of police provocation at large-scale demonstrations currently, what can we expect to see down the road as the movement becomes more effective?
I think it goes back to this point of confusion.
Uh-huh.
And to clarify where I'm going with that is simply to say that there is a continuum of options of response, for lack of a better term, because we have things which are egregious miscarriages of justice before us. We have crimes against humanity before us. We have war crimes before us. We have corporatization and the implications of that before us. We have things which are tangibly, fundamentally, hideously lethal in their implications for broad swaths of humanity. We're responding to that. It's not like we seized an initiative here, okay? We're responding to a tangible circumstance, and we have a range of options available to us by way of mounting that response. And these need to be assessed in terms of their effectuality, but we have these principles of purity that intervene to foreclose upon consideration of whole ranges of those options. If we were to break down that mental barrier, which leads to self-indulgence in a certain way of remaining safe in the face of opposition, but bearing moral witness and feeling morally pure and somehow separate from the system you're supporting by constraining activity to that. If you broke that down so that people who had an actual principle that prevented them from engaging physically with their opponents nonetheless understood that not everybody shared that principle, and were, while they did not engage in that physical confrontation, supportive of those who did, we would eliminate the sea of confusion in which the provocateurs swim, so that we had a coherent response in terms of separating one thing from another and supporting those who are on the same side of barricades as we. One reason these provocateur tactics have proven so effective is because the bulk of the so-called movement shrinks away in horror from those who are accused of activities, and frankly, bombing an ROTC building, which was the rubric of the Tommy Tongyi operation, is property damage as well. They weren't attacking people, okay? That gets conflated with violence, and everyone retreats. These people are isolated, and then they're easily neutralized. If we understood our politics more correctly, they would not be isolated, and they could not be neutralized with the efficiency the state's been able to do it in the past. So while people who actually are pacifists and want to engage in that praxis are perfectly entitled to do that, they have an obligation to be supportive of those who disagree but oppose the same people they do at the same time. You don't have to be a bearer of arms to support those who do bear arms. And in fact, that is the practice with regard to external movements. Okay, you've got nonviolent movements that purport to be in solidarity with the people of El Salvador in the process of an armed insurrection. You've got people here who are nonviolent people in their practice who purport to be in solidarity with the EZLN and Chiapas. And you've got a long history of that. You've got a nonviolent movement that purported to be in solidarity with the NLF in Vietnam. Okay, and they could understand how they could be nonviolent in their practice here and in solidarity with people who were not nonviolent in their practice somewhere else. They need to make that same sort of link up in their minds with regard to people who are not nonviolent within the United States itself, because there is no exemption to the United States. It bears responsibility for what it does, and the consequences often will have to be visited in order to make that point clear.
What do you think the largest obstacle that stands between sort of this, like we're calling the anti-corporate globalization movement and indigenous struggles within the United States?
Well, the same corporations are ravaging the so-called third world out there beyond the boundaries of the United States are also ravaging the internal colonies of Native North America, and the cost and consequence in human terms that pertains in the third world pertains just as much to Native North America, or in some cases, arguably even more. Okay? So the same set of rules of how one goes about opposing what it is that's being done would apply here as applied there, okay, and the same kinds of solidarity between mainstream opposition movements and third world liberationist movements the applicability of that would be the same with the fourth world colonies inside the United States as is pertinent to solidarity with third world liberation movements elsewhere.
I guess I was thinking more like in terms of in this country, there are steps being taken by like white activists to sort of address the issues that have always plagued us, this sort of socialized racism and trying to, you know, sort of become, work together against a common enemy. And I think it's, you know, an issue of white and black and Latino, you know, but it seems like the Indian element is often left out. And I seem to think it's in part because, I don't know, maybe it's the geography of it, where there's the concentrations of Indian population are on reserves that are out of, you know, the general population in a large part. Maybe there's other reasons. I was just curious as if you thought maybe you could speak on that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I think the omission of Native people from that sort of triangulated paradigm you're talking about is not so much a matter of accident is coincident, okay, because the opposition shares with the status quo a notion that it has both an entitlement to indigenous property and a better way of going about organizing the proceeds of what derives from that property, okay? They want to redivide it on the left, okay, in a more equitable fashion, but the fundamental fact issue is that somebody else's property that's being divided has to be avoided, okay, because in the alternative, you wouldn't have an overarching prerogative to make the decisions of how the division is to occur. And there's a self-entitlement process that's going on, which leaves us with a frightening prospect that where most of the progressive agendas that are out there on the table in the United States or in North America as a whole to be fulfilled, you would end up with, in some way, much more equitable society for the colonizing population, but it would still be a colonizing entity, okay, imposing itself upon a colonized strata called Native North Americans. You got to peel that onion all the way back in Foucauldian manner to where the disjuncture occurred, where things went awry in historical terms, take first things first and rebuild a just order on that basis. So the first issue to confront any serious and honest opposition movement in the United States, how to resolve the issue of territorial disposition. Decolonization of Native North America is agenda item number one. And on that basis, you can build more equitable relations in economic terms, in gender terms, and all the rest of those terms, okay, but you cannot do any of those things in a satisfactory fashion until you resolve the fundamental issue, and the fundamental issue is who owns the ground and the assets in the ground upon which whatever society is to be here is constituted. And Burlington, actually, let me do a follow-up on that, because there's a perfect lead line in that little bash piece that was in the local newspaper yesterday in honor of my appearing here, which is, and actually I would reject the description in a certain sense, but I was announced as being a foremost expert in terms of the plight of Native North American people. And from that, it was adduced that very few people in Vermont would know who I was, which is the same as saying it's got to do with Native issues, so nobody's going to be conscious of them, and that is the fundamental problem that is at issue. And I would like to thank that reporter, whatever his name was, for making my point precisely. That's the most serious issue confronting the entirety of the United States in terms of its self-construction, and it is the least known, and that didn't happen by accident either. Thanks for bringing that out, guy.
I was curious as to what your vision, I mean, because it would assume it's, I'm not asking you to speak on behalf of, you know, your people, but just from your personal perspective, what is your topic or utopic vision of what that would look like?
Oh, every good Republican in the state ought to be able to relate to this, law enforcement. Okay, starting with the big laws, however, not buckle your seatbelts, not petty theft. I'm talking about the theft of the entire continent. There's treaty relations which, according to the Constitution of the United States, are enunciated as the supreme law of the land, every one of which has been violated by the United States and the beneficiary population, which aligns itself as being good Americans. Get in conformity with law, okay? Enforce the law you contend the entire rest of the planet has to obey on yourselves first, and we'll resolve quite a lot of the issues at hand with regard to property disposition in North America, because it's delineated in the treaties. Get yourself in compliance with the treaties, okay? So law enforcement or obedience to law, all those things Republicans say are so important. Let them start with themselves.
So these are, I guess, two things. First is the treaties were written, you know, a long time ago, and they were signed by people who have long since passed. And
murder statute was written quite a while ago, too, by somebody who had passed. Does that mean we don't acknowledge its force and authority?
Well, I'm thinking if we're gonna really do this, and we really want to see it happen in the most in a way which serves everyone, you know, indigenous people to this continent first, since they're the ones who really. You know, we're talking about land. I mean, this is all of their land. Mm-hmm. Would you rather, you know, rewrite, you know, a lot of those treaties?
No, I'm content with what my ancestors negotiated, and I would assume that the dominant population should be, too, because they honor those ancestors, okay? They honor the founding fathers and all that. And we're talking about instruments to go back that have Thomas Jefferson's and George Washington's signature on them, as well as a number of the other luminaries whose faces appear in a currency of the United States. You're going to have to be good with it anyway because it's the law. Okay, no one asks you whether you like the law. You simply have to obey the law, boys and girls. That applies to the guys who are writing the laws now, just the same as it applies to everybody out there who doesn't get to write the laws. You have to obey the damn things, okay? However inconvenient that may be. Otherwise, you're a criminal, okay? And I'm against criminality. And this actually works in behalf are in the interest of all of these people with progressive agendas that say they're against corporatism and so forth, because the ultimate effect of this particular element of law enforcement is to eliminate the foundation or the base for this corporatist thrust to globalization, okay? You unpack the empire. You dismantle the empire by its own rules, okay? You simply have to insist that it abide by the rules that it set forth to constitute itself in the first place. And at that point, cannot act as it does now. So you can pick yourself a point, whether it's being opposed to sweatshops or being opposed to apartheid and racism, homophobia, sexism, ageism, any of those famous isms antithetical to progressive values are addressed in this particular agenda. They're not all resolved, but it sets a basis or predication for resolution that is presently non-existent. It will remain non-existent until this is addressed. That's the beauty of it. You're just going to have to stop acting on the basis of self-interest, presumed entitlement to privilege and so forth, suck it up, look the thing in the face, and figure out how to get it done.
Do you think this can happen without, within the context of a capitalist society? Or, you know, I think, could it, an indigenous... I guess the problem I'm having is that I'm not that familiar with the treaties that were written, and you know, it's as much my fault as it is the educational.
Well, that is true, because the information is available if you saw a particular interest, and I would have to say self-interest, because it is yourself we're talking about in learning that. So maybe that's one of those moments. You just discovered you had some homework to do, so
yeah.
Get busy.
I think I discovered it last night when you were speaking then. But
we all have work to do. We don't stop learning. We don't have all the answers. There's not a pill that can be taken that suddenly makes you all-knowing. You know, you have to work at it. That's why we call this stuff struggle, okay?
Right.
Consciousness is a part of the struggle. Engaging that consciousness in the material forms required to construct change of a positive sort is also a part of the struggle. Those two things are linked, okay? Theory and practice, you call it praxis. If you're a Westerner, we just call it living, if you're on the other side of the thing, because those are integrated anyway. But whichever one you call it, you have to harness one to the other in a way that leads to the result desired. But we got that confusion as to what the result is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of clarifies that confusion. No, capitalism, at least in the form that it is now understood, is impossible in a construction where self-determination of all peoples is actually, and that's a legal principle, it was actually implemented in a way that had meaning in substance rather than simply in rhetoric. We don't even have the rhetoric at this point. We've got the denial of the right to self-determination. Well, self-determination is both a natural and a legal right. So we're going to stand on those rights. And once again, demand law enforcement and obedience to law of people who are otherwise criminals, beginning with those in power in the United States. And anyone aligned with them, for that matter. They're not innocent people. They're people who are either perpetrators or complicit in the perpetration of genocide against. How should we stack it? What's the historical framework? I can make a case that we're talking 80% of the world's population been subjected to genocidal ravages in this process. Genocide's the top of the heap in terms of crimes against humanity.
So in if I understand it right, I mean, a lot of what you're saying is that, you know, we're fighting for something that actually would embody a lot of the things that on paper we already have. But what we're trying to do is actualize it, you know, create a system that actually allows for the self-determination, you know, the protection of people's rights and abilities to do the things that makes them them. And
there are certain things you can do with a paper guarantee, usually in an outhouse, okay? It's the material reality which is at issue. We understand our rights as they are articulated on paper, but what we have to concern ourselves with is the practical reality as to whether those rights are in any way implemented, okay? And the extent to which they're denied and how to transcend that denial. Replace it with a practical reality rather than simply a rhetorical articulation.
Well, what can this movement offer to this, you know, the native struggle? You know, let's not say, from coming from where I, you know, from my perspective, I see this, you know, I see the issues with the government, and I see the issues with capitalism, and I see what I think I should do, you know, in organizing the people who are affected by that system in such a way that we force the change that needs to happen. But for me, I think it's more about finding out what those people's perspectives are than it is mine, being a white male, you know, coming from an upper class. It's hard for me to really envision, like, what, you know, the way I can use my privilege to, and my everything that I've been bestowed with to work to the end of the people who...
Not at all. That privilege has bestowed you with certain skills and aptitudes and so forth that are largely denied in certain other communities. And you might go to those communities and ask how those particular skills might be harnessed. Not go in and tell them what it is you can do for them, but ask them
right,
what it is that you might be able to do for them. They'll probably tell you not much, but stick around a while. They'll probably find things for you to do. Those things might begin with things that are completely wide of what your skills level leads you to believe you should be doing. You might end up cooking soup or pushing a broom for a while, but eventually it'll work its way into another set of relations. It takes a while. You're not automatically entitled to acceptance coming from the particular background you're coming from, but understand, as we understand, that white is more than anything a state of mind. And if you prove that you're not imbued with that state of mind, then you're going to be accepted as something other than a signifier of whiteness.
Now, that's on a personal level. What do you think about, you know, on a movement level?
Essentially, it's the same thing. Look, there's a couple of ways that you can go at things, okay? You can hear what people are saying and try to be responsive to them and ask further questions of how you can make your personal engagement and be in some way effective and efficient in accomplishing something good. Or you can do like the idiot did at the rally yesterday, which is listen to everything that I had to say, come up and inform me. I guess he expected gushing gratitude as a result, telling me that he agreed with most of what I had to say, like, okay, and then proceeding to go into this auctioneer's lecturette about how I should have said it better instead, and in face of that arrogance, getting all offended when I'm basically, I told him to fuck off, okay, and telling me I would never reach anybody because I'm arrogant. The presumption that there's always somebody coming from that background who will know better what the issue is and how it ought to be articulated than the people who are on the receiving end of it, okay, is the fundamental aspect of the arrogance that goes into the genocidal mentality that would need to be opposition to. So you got two polarities there. And you can make a selection as to which one of those polarities you want to be closer to. Okay? But also understand that this was not some right-wing Republican talking. This was someone who fancied themselves all liberal and enlightened and progressive on my side. Okay? Yeah, I liked what you had to say in large part. Now, you need to eliminate part of it, and the rest of it you need to re-say the way I'd say it. Well, look, man, if you got something you want to say, get up there and say it yourself. Don't be presuming to come down and tell me how I should speak. The Wog can speak on his own. Thank you very much. See, that's the attitude that prevents constructive alliances and so forth from occurring. And that's been the history clear back as long as I've been actively conscious, back into the days of New Left, when SNCC activists, for example, Stokely Carmichael and Rap Brown and others, basically expelled all the whites from SNCC. Not because they weren't good people and not because they weren't doing good work, but because they presumed they could do the work better than any of the black people whose liberation struggle they had joined in. Okay? And a little humility goes a long way. And for this arrogance, the repudiation or rejection of that arrogance to be in itself deemed arrogant speaks to the sense of entitlement that has been carried around in the white progressive movement, and that needs to be overcome.
Yeah. I feel like I've been sort of talking about the native struggle as this monolithic thing, you know, and I know that, yeah, you know, each group is very diverse and very different. And what do you think some of the challenges are? Because, this past spring, there's a group of activists that went to Akwesasne and crossed into Canada, you know, with members of OCAP and the Warriors Council. And there was a lot of controversy that emerged from Akwesasne because of, you know, the different factions on the res. And there was part of the community that didn't want us there at all. Mostly those who had positions of power and authority within that community, and it put us in a really uncomfortable position because we really didn't know what when we accepted the invitation, we didn't know what we were getting into. Did you hear anything about this? Were you familiar with it?
I've been doing politics in Native North America for a long time, and that's a condition that you're going to encounter virtually everywhere. You know, the glib response would be, say, wages of colonialism are a bitch, aren't they? Okay? And Indians don't all think alike. And we're factionalized by virtue of our colonization to a considerable extent, and that's true in any colonial context you want to name. And guess what? When Wilford Burchett was going down the Ho Chi Minh Trail with the NVA, important supplies into South Vietnam to support the war effort there, he wasn't real popular with the Tu regime, okay? They were Vietnamese too, but they were aligned with colonial powers. You have to understand the political construction of things and the implications of those political constructions. Whoever told you it was going to be comfortable to participate in an anti-colonial struggle misled you extremely.
Point taken. I just, you know, the fear really is that are we further exacerbating divides within that community by coming in, or do we
it's
have
not
the
your choice to make? Actually, your choice is to whether you're going to respond to an invitation from an obviously integral and, in your perception, liberatory element of the community to be there for whatever particular reason or not. But as to what the implications within the community itself are going to be, that's for the community itself to make a determination about. And that's both sides of this factional dispute. They're going to take their positions according, and you're not responsible for those. But there's a big difference between responding to an invitation to come and do a specific thing, whether it's simply to observe or to perform some concrete service on the one hand, and interjecting yourself as some sort of a journalist or outside expert or whatever, uninvited. Very different thing. Very different thing. So the key is in being solicited or invited to be there for whatever reason the people who are extending the invitation deem appropriate. And you make your own choices whether you think they're the progressive forces or not progressive forces, whether you want to be associated with that particular group or not associated with that particular group, whether you want any association with the struggle that's going on there at all because of the level of understanding about its internal dynamics that you manifest. Sometimes it's better to just decline in a respectful way and stay out of it. But there's not a uniform formulation that can be advanced. Say, do this or do that. It's very, very situational, and it's dependent on not only the context of the community, but your own consciousness. Probably you don't want to accept the invitation to go and have a learning experience. That's sort of parasitical. Yeah.
Every experience is a learning experience.
Well, that's true, but if that's your primary motive for going, if it's sort of like this, like political voyeur or tourist, all right, it sort of speaks for itself. It probably hadn't ought to show up.
Something that you'd mentioned last night was the use of native names by the dominant culture. And I was thinking specifically about the use of these names by the military-industrial complex, you know, for things, tools of destruction, you know, like the Tomahawk missile or the Apache helicopter.
Okay, sure. I didn't mention those last night. I was talking about Winnebago campers and Jeep Cherokees because that's sort of like very prominent marketing in civilian society. But yeah, the weapons of war would show up on CNN all the time, the Tomahawk cruise and the Apache helicopter and the Black Hawk, for that matter, which is named for a specific individual who happened to be a leader of the Meskaki and Sauk people where I grew up in Illinois. Yeah. There is this essentially at issue here would be analogous. What's at issue would be analogous to the Germans deciding to name sports teams the Yids, okay, or I don't know. I'm not that familiar with Jewish terminology and what would be correspondent, but I don't, a Hanukkah attack helicopter, I don't know, a rabbinical missile, such things as that. And then to argue when there is some protest from, oh, I don't know, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, wherever the protest would be emerging from, that they were actually intending to honor the Jewish people. Well, given the history of the relationship between the Germans and the Jews, this sort of appropriation of Jewish terminology to a name, the instrumentalities of German economic and military dominance probably could not conceivably be construed that way, and for the very good reason that it wouldn't be that way, and that same principle pertains here. This hasn't got a thing to do with honoring Native people. It's got to do with dehumanizing, trivializing, appropriating us, consuming us in a symbolic way by the cannibalistic, parasitical culture that imposed itself upon us. So it's another act of degradation and aggression. And it's ubiquitous. It's ubiquitous. We were running it down last night. Everything from kids' writing tablets, Big Chief, all the way up to the Tomahawk cruise missile. And every stop along the way. And it's nothing. Nothing is restricted. We were talking about Squaw last night and the implications of naming 4,000 place names for female genitalia. And basically, they're running around very glibly referring to anything female that happens to be Native as a cunt. And announcing, arguing, in all seriousness, there's nothing wrong with it. And actually, it's kind of cute, and even in some cases intended to honor women. Yeah, well, play it in English and see how many women are honored. Yeah.
I think it's also interesting. I was waiting for you this morning. I was thinking, you know, just about myself and my own experience, and I come from a town called Hohokus. You know, it's obviously not an Anglo name, and I have no idea what that means. And I was thinking more about, you know, my town, and I was thinking about my experience with the Boy Scouts. And
were you Order of the Arrow?
I was. I went once, and I left because it was so – it made me ill. I mean,
it began with the Weebelows, didn't it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, the whole – it just reeks of this, like –
Yeah, reeks is a good word. The stench swirls around it. But that's good, wholesome, clean fun for, yavol, the Hitler Youth.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is.
And the children who are sucked into this have nothing to say about it. They don't know any better. The adults should, but they're deliberately doing this to their children, okay? And the idea of this sort of trivialization, in some ways glorification, commodification of genocide is what it amounts to, really. The stench that's wafting off this whole package ought to force anyone of any conscience at all who actually considers it to want a wretch.
Well,
those are good, innocent Americans there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, who knew? I didn't know when I was 12 years old.
No, you didn't.
I thought it was really interesting. I mean,
but you listen to the tirades that are coming across the media right now. You read the editorials. You read the defensive responses. You catch it in the progressive movement, and all you can do is stand back in astonishment, in a way, at the virulence of it all, and start to hum Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles. Okay? Well, I don't hear anybody arguing the horrendous crime of humanity that was committed by the 8th Air Force strategic bombing of Germany. And guess what? By the definitions used here, those were, up to and including Adolf Eichmann, all innocent people. I mean, we got this weird thing. Everybody talks about the horror of the process that is America and globalization and military projection and all that. But funny thing about it, nobody seems to be doing it. Anybody on the American side of things gets hurt at all, somehow or another, they were by definition innocent. What do you have to do to actually carry some culpability in this country for what it is that everybody seems to acknowledge this country is doing? I know we got computer consoles, and as John Ross was pointing out last night, the firing of cruise missiles and such. But we all are pretty much consensed analytically that the military is in service to corporate interest. And if those people sitting in the top of those towers on the 911 weren't the corporate technical elite, I can't imagine who on earth would be. And if the corporatization of the planet is what's at issue here in rendering these holocaustal effects in other areas of the world, who would be more responsible than they? Where would you find a legitimate target? Basically, the argument is brown-skinned people are supposed to sit out there starving to death in their hundreds of thousands and millions indefinitely until the opposition in this country finds some pill it can take that will allow for a painless solution that preserves its privilege and nobody will get hurt here. But the onus of responsibility of them is to die politely and silently out there, out of sight and out of mind, while we remain sanitary and painless here. Sorry, that's American exceptionalism of the very worst kind. Very worst kind. You have to understand the reality of it. If you push people around, and genocide is certainly pushing people around, and continue to do so as a way of life and predicate your so-called quality of life upon a perpetration of that genocide on a perpetual basis, eventually somebody is going to have to push back. And they did. And there were certainly innocent people that died on 9-1-1. They didn't include all of these that get lumped in with them. By the time these people get done whining about what happened on that date, you think there were no one but food service workers in that building. And yes, there were some children. I count five. And I mourn those children as I mourn those food service workers who were actually there. But I mourn those five children 1/100,000 as much as I do the 500,000 Iraqi children I was talking about yesterday, who those people up in those towers are very much responsible for having died. Treating their economic endeavors, their technical endeavors, as a sporting contest at the expense of starving children in Iraq speaks for itself. I am 1/100,000 as mourning of the five American children who died on 9-1-1 as I am of the 500,000 Iraqi children, and we could list it out from there. But that's a genuine mourning. And I do mourn those undocumented workers who died in that building that day, but not one bit more than I do their compatriots in the third world who are dying in droves every single day while the order that was manifested out of the World Trade Center perpetuates itself as a predator on the rest of the population of the globe.
That was Ward Churchill speaking with Free Radio Burlington.